Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Controls Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets.
You did, and in fact that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy, how are you?
I'm very, very well. I know that today will be a bit of a fave for you.
You see, this is Derek Shulman, right, who is the singer and the main guy, if you like. Well, one of a few of the three brothers. Three brothers, the Shulman brothers, who started the band Gentle Giant. And we've mentioned them a lot on the show, haven't we, over the year?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, sometimes ironically.
Well, I think they're popped.
No, because they are the zenith. Let's face it, they are the zenith of kind of clever prog. And, you know.
They are.
And, yeah.
I mean, they out prog prog, don't they?
They do out prog prog. I mean, I've been listening to them for the last few days, you know, trying to get my... And basically, I've kind of had to take a break from my head exploding and sort of listening to something simple like Marla.
You know, I don't want to put the listener off who doesn't know Gentle Giant, because there are
no,
some...
they're amazing. They are amazing.
Absolutely. And they were one of the bands to have in the quad, you know, growing up as a kid, when you were sort of experimenting with different musical sounds. They were one of the bands.
No, absolutely. Oh, but talking about... There's an interesting thing. We had a comment on Twitter... Dave Malloy, I think it was, who came up with the Rockonteurs checklist about, like, does it have the three things, which are prog, Bowie, and Bolan.
Ah.
And actually, we can get all three in on this one, if we play our cards right.
Well, we can. You're absolutely right, and we will.
Yeah. Damn it, and or die trying.
Derek's career is quite incredible because it starts in the 60s with Psychedelia, and actually, at one point, Sid gets involved.
That's right.
Yeah, Sid Barrett.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Then it moves into serious prog with Gentle Giant. Don't get me started on that.
The Jolly Green Giant. I'm sorry, but because, you know, the first album did have that face on it, it did make me think of the Sweet Corn a bit.
I know. Anyway, so Gentle Giant. And then he's involved in two of the biggest records ever in global pop music.
Yeah, and don't you think this is... Well, we'll talk about that. Don't give everything away.
No.
Do you think it's quite ironic that these guys set themselves a task of making this incredibly difficult, you know, or sophisticated music? And they did as well as they possibly could, I would say. And, you know, we're still talking about... But the great irony is that when he goes off, it turns out if there's one thing he can do, it's spot a hit.
Yeah. I think we should start the conversation when we get him on any second now with this viral video that went around last year of one of their more difficult tunes that became, it won the prog event of the year for Prog Magazine.
That's right, for the song Proclamation, which I think was done all over the world. It was his son, wasn't it, who arranged it?
We're going to talk about it. Yeah. Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me?
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hi, Derek. Listen, can I say it's such a pleasure having you on, Derek, because your name and your band's name, your old band's name, have come up a lot on Rock Haunters in different places and sometimes really surprising places. Obviously, when we're talking about progressive music from the early 70s, it pops up. But took it to Jon Bon Jovi on one of our earlier podcasts. And there you were. You know, I don't think, you know, I'd ever made that association until studying your history.
I'm the Forrest Gump of rock and roll.
It's true. Well, that's what, and Pat Leonard, of course, was very big. So you were basically his inspiration.
It's funny, you're finally getting gold records when you didn't get them in the band, probably. You know?
Yes, actually, that's actually true, believe it or not. Yeah.
Do you know what I think it is? When in the early 70s, when I was buying your albums, you know, it was a big commitment to buy a record. You know, Gentle Giant weren't the sort of act you'd hear on the radio. So you'd go into a shop and you'd see, like, you know, the amazing, you know, George Underwood cover or the Roger Dean cover. And you think, you know, I'm going to give this a listen. And you'd spend the money and take it home. But now this music is all out there for free. And I think a lot of kids, and they're skimming this music and they're finding it, you know, and it sounds fresh.
Especially all the wonderful new remixes.
With Stephen, of course. Yeah,
well, I've got to say, I actually went up to Stephen's studio and he played me the Atmos mix of On Reflection from Freehand, which was just mind-blowing. Yeah,
I mean, Stephen's is a friend, of course, you know, as well as a you know, as well as an incredible musician, and he's captured all of his mixes. Actually, are fantastic because he really gives the music a little more space and air that we, I guess, in those days couldn't put it on tape, as it were, then. But he's also very, he doesn't put his stamp on it per se. No. He allows the music to continue as it was, but allows it to breathe, if you like. So yeah, the Atmos mix of Freehand in particular. But he's also done a couple of others going forward, which we're looking forward to putting out soon.
Yeah, I heard that mix that Guy's talking about at Stevens as well, and in 8.1. And
oh, really?
Of course, it suits what you did, because what a lot of what you did had this kind of incredible vocal arrangement where you and your two brothers and maybe Kerry were, you know, making this sort of fugue-like music with singing, almost medieval.
Well, some of it was, yeah. I mean, and some of it was kind of damn hard to sing. Let me tell you, a lot of it was scored, of course. I mean, Kerry was and is, I mean, an unbelievable musician. I mean, we're talking about the very top-notch, I would say, classical musician that we turned into a rock and roller, you know, despite his kicking and screaming. So, you know, we were very fortunate in having Kerry, who had, you know, had a degree in composition as well as percussion, coming from the Royal Academy of Music and have a degree, you know, and studying under incredible mentors, if you like. He scored a lot of these pieces that you're talking about, the a cappella stuff.
Also incredible to think what your start points were for any of your pieces, because they all go to so many places.
But you know what? If anyone is listening out there to as a musician, I would hope you'll find it interesting that every piece, if you like, I'm not going to song, because sometimes they weren't really songs, they had a theme. So you'll hear whatever you'll hear on top, whether it's a vocal part or the guitar part or other parts in the music or the bass part, you'll hear the thematic structure of the piece. I mean, I'm not saying you were the London Symphony Orchestra or anything like that, because we were a rock and roll band, end of story. But we enjoyed playing together and pushing ourselves, actually, just on a personal level musically.
Gotcha. Yeah, but it's interesting what Guy says, because it is, you know, it's so complex, the music, but very fulfilling. And what I loved about progressive music as a kid, and I want to say progressive music because it wasn't the sort of stuff you get on Top of the Pops, is that it could take me places forever. You know, I was never bored with this. I was always discovering, because it was always pushing the time signatures, changing the keys. But what he's saying, and I do want to just follow up on that, is something like a track called Just the Same, which I think is on In a Glasshouse. It credits you as being the sole writer for that song.
No, I think that Just the Same is me, Kerry and Ray. That was on Freehand, I believe.
How was the writing approach?
Well, for the most part, Ray, my brother, and Kerry, you know, me, Ray and Kerry, would sit there with a Revox, you know, two-track machine in those days, and we'd sit in our various rooms, houses, apartments, flats, whatever, or, you know, kitchens, and fiddle around until we thought we had something, which is something, a riff or a little piece that could be expanded on. And then, and I would say 80% to 90% was either Ray or Carrie who would write the music part. I would come in with about 10 to 15%. And then we three get together and put these pieces together so that it made a composite of what the song or the piece of music, song, track or whatever, was all about. And then the lyrics would come out of that, the music that was already written. So basically it was one thing we never did was, you know, go into a rehearsal room and jam. You know, that's, yeah. that's, you know, we were never kind of like, hey, John, put, you know, lay down a 4-4. Come on, let's see what kind of chords you can come up with. That was never a gentle giant. We'd come in with ideas and then we'd sit down with, you know, when we had some formula or formulated kind of music, then John and Gaz, Gary would come in. We'd say, oh, look, here are the parts.
Great bass player, I suppose.
Oh, Ray's superb.
Yeah.
Yeah, really is. We were pretty good, you know, back in the day. It's funny because I even, you know, having looked back on my life in music, if you like, I was in a band even before Gentle Giant.
Well, we're going to get on
to
that.
Oh, yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Oh, well, I'm not sure if you should look forward to it or not, but anyway, more recently, in the last couple of years, several years actually, the popularity of the band is bizarre because it's become probably as big, if not bigger, than it was when we were going, and more popular with the younger generation, which is, you know, so I guess I'm happy to say that there's an element of timelessness to it. Who knew? Because we were just doing it ultimately for ourselves, and then we got on stage, and hopefully an audience would come see us and pay their money, and we could put bread on the table, if you like.
I'm not that surprised about the increase in popularity because it's interesting from young people I know, children and stuff, that there seems to be a move towards more complexity in music just because pop music, everything from hip-hop to just general pop, has become so melodically simple over the last few years. And there's a lot of kind of young bands who are going down quite a jazzy direction or yeah. something. And I think that's why people now are looking to the past because people just want a bit of chops. You know, because the only place you kind of found chops for the last few years is that super heavy metal, and that's really yeah. quite a task to listen to.
Well, some, yeah, but yeah. no, I think you're correct. Actually, I think there's a quasi backlash on machine music, if you like, and mm-hmm. the producers who have a formula. There's no real melody per se. There's no choruses. There's no you know, it's just there's a formula for a hit, which is in the zeros and ones. I mean, of a computer generated mm-hmm. kind of music. Which I don't judge. I mean, if it's popular, it's popular. If a 5-second TikTok piece yeah. is popular.
Can I just say, Guy, that ironically, Derek is probably responsible for some of that super heavy metal that you just mentioned.
That's why I jumped in and said, yes, okay.
But I was also saying that's where all the chops are. That yeah. is where the
musicianship
is.
I'm thinking because later on in his career, we're citing Pantera. But and, exactly, and talking yeah. about yeah. you know, young people digging your music and this sort of rebirth of Gentle Giant is in this recent lockdown video that went viral.
Oh, yes!
Of Proclamation from Power and the Glory. I mean, that's just yeah. unbelievable. That 6-minute track with how many musicians? Anyone who hasn't seen it, go and yeah, it's Google brilliant. Proclamation, Gentle Giant, and recent video.
And it was your son, wasn't it, who arranged that, Derek?
Yeah, my son Noah, who was born after we stopped performing. I mean, it's my son, but he's an incredibly talented, creative force in his own right with video and music and other. He's the head of creative at Sony Legacy. But he's been begging me and the other guys, you know, when he sees them, just one more show because I've never seen you. And I said, Noah, look at your father. I'm an old fart, for God's sake. You know, but he was able to get us to be part of this video. And the good thing is he saw so many younger people play the various songs from various albums. And he thought what a good idea it would be to just put some joy out there because we were in the middle of a lockdown. It was awful. And there was 120. He had to literally cut it down to 120 tracks or pieces of instrumentation. And he got the whole band to perform in this in some way or other. And then poor Ray, my brother Ray, he had to contend with actually putting the sound together. I mean, really mixing the sound of 120 different guys, that's hardcore.
Yeah.
I think you're right. It turned out amazingly. And I'm really happy that people saw it.
This seems like a good place to jump back, because we're now, we're talking about your son, we're talking about third generation, right? Because it all comes from your dad, doesn't it? With you three brothers being so musical.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, my father was, in those days, it was called a dance band leader. He loved jazz and classical. You know, he played trumpet in a band in Portsmouth. He'd pick up any instrument. And I guess that sort of genetic material in our DNA was handed down to all of us here. He would be able to pick up any instrument, whether it's a clarinet, trumpet, bagpipes, and be able to play them, you know, with incredible skill within 5 minutes. And music was always around the house. When he finished a gig, he'd bring back a couple of musicians, and they'd actually play in our house and until 4 a.m, just for fun. You know, and I creep downstairs and it's like, get back up, you've got to go to school tomorrow. Music was always part of my, since I was conceived, I guess. So in that respect, I guess we were all lucky.
So just fill me in. So you were born and brought up initially in the Gorbals in Scotland. There's you and your brother Phil and Ray. I don't know what the age differences are. And then you end up moving out of Portsmouth for some reason.
I was born in Glasgow. Ray was not. Ray was born in Portsmouth. My father was posted. He was a paratrooper during the war, and God knows where he went. But he ended up in Portsmouth. And the Gorbals in I don't remember, because I was only 2 years old when I moved down. But my brother Phil remembered it. And the Gorbals was probably as awful as Ukraine it is right now. You know, the hardest core place to be brought up in.
Well, yeah, Gary and I talked about it the other day. We were saying we remember when we were kids, it was the sort of place you'd see World in Action documentaries about.
Oh, yeah. You walk down the street, you turn around and look at someone, you get knifed in the face or got. So you got the hell out of there. You know, it was a Catholics versus Protestants versus Jews and got Irish versus, you know, who knows? So when he was stationed near Portsmouth, he went down there. This is a better place to bring up my family. And then Ray was born, you know, a couple of years after me.
I mean, what you do in Gentle Giant is you're all swapping instruments nonstop. Yeah. I mean, one of you's playing the saxophone. What kind of instruments were in the house and how did you learn all of these things?
As I said, I mean, it was like, I think it came from, you know, again, our DNA. It was, we'd be able to pick up an instrument. We all play guitar. I play guitar, you know, but not great, but I could certainly strum a few chords. But, you know, Ray was a guitarist initially in the first group we were in. A group called Simon Dupree and the Big Sound.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
We love Simon Dupree and the Big Sound.
Really? Okay, well, I did too, actually. No. It was a fantastic time.
There's no Simon Dupree and there's not really a Big Sound. So it's kind of the same etymological route as like Monty Python's Flying Circus, so, isn't it? It's just a name and a thing.
You're right. It was probably virtually the same thing anyway, actually. It was being able to pick up an instrument and we weren't like masters of, I could play guitar, but I'm not a wangy, amazing player like Gary is, but I could certainly play some guitar. We all could play fairly well, but obviously we got really good at certain things. Gary is really a keyboard genius and Ray is an incredible player.
But let's talk about Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, because I mean, you obviously started off in a very, what should we say, what kind of music is it, Guy? It had a kind of Walker Brothers feel about it.
It had the Walker Brothers slightly R&B thing and very, very pop. But what's interesting, especially in the keyboards, is you can hear there's this sort of nascent prog waiting to get out, I think.
You know, initially, to tell you the truth, when we started, we started when I was at school, of course. You know, all schoolboys in those days wanted to be the Beatles. Yeah. They started everything. A couple of school friends, I said, let's put a group together. You know, and so we got a school group together with my friends who were at school. With one, you know, the drummer played pots and pans on drums. I had a Spanish guitar, and then my father bought me the first electric guitar, Vox, a red Vox 3 pickup. God knows what it was. And Ray played, he was a violinist, was being trained, and in fact had a place at the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain to be the lead violinist. And I said, right, come join the band. You could be rhythm violinist, which he was initially.
Not a lot of ads in the back of the Melody Maker for a rhythm violinist, it must be said.
But the future was there, you know, Atomic Rooster and all these other bands that, you know, embraced the violin. Eddie Jobson.
We started getting serious about being in a band. We got a couple of gigs. And then, you know, we started playing while I was at school, you know, in the fifth, sixth form and fifth form. And we got good. But what we used to do is listen to American Forces Network at Radio Luxembourg. And we were really a soul band initially. Mm-hmm. You know, we were playing all the sort of, you know, like every other band in those days. I mean, the Beatles were, the Stones were, you know, we listed all the blues and everyone was doing the same thing. I mean, you know, we'd all be playing the American music that the Americans didn't even know they had. Ultimately, we'd be playing like 9 or 10 gigs a week, no matter where you were. And, you know, I was just leaving school. My Ray was still at school. We became fairly good. I mean, to get those kind of chops. A quick sidebar story was is that I went to grammar school. And in those days, the grammar school was all boys with the teachers with mortar boards and the cloaks and, you know, God knows what else. And at 13, this careers teacher came, to our class. And you know, at grammar school in those days, you were supposed to be the politicians of the future, the scientists, the elite. It was a real class. It's so stupid. Because thank God it's different now, but I got a scholarship. Anyway, and I at 13, I said, I want to be a rock star. And the class is, you know, right. The master said, don't be so stupid, Shulman. Well, you know, 3.5 years later, we had our first single and we were on radio. Well, it was late program in those days. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being mocked as someone who, you know, had no clue about what that meant. And the masses coming up before an autograph, which is the most. And then we turned pro, you know, as it were.
But it was definitely psychedelia. You embraced psychedelia as well, didn't you, with that?
We did. And then we had, a very, very, we had 3 singles in the top 40, which luckily we kept us going. We had a very good following, actually. We were good live. We learned stagecraft, actually. And that's what a lot of bands, whether it's Led Zeppelin, Stones, you know, whoever you were back in those days, if you played 10 gigs a week or more, and that you could do that in those days, you learned to, you know, get either good or you just gave up.
The song Kites was your top 10 hit, I think, you know, which is a great tune.
Which you were on record as saying, I don't know how long ago this was, you said you thought it was utter shite, which I think is a bit harsh. I wonder if you've reconsidered your view in the fullness of time.
Absolutely, of course. It wasn't a style in which we were used to playing, but our manager, who was in fact my brother-in-law, said this is a great song.
Keep it in the family,
of course, you know, this is nepotism plus. He said, I think this could really work. And we listened to it and said, oh, God, do we really have to? And I said, okay, let's give it a shot. Our keyboard player, Eric, the keyboard player, you know, in fact, the Mellotron in the studio in Abbey Road was the Beatles Mellotron. Anyway, it became a massive hit, you know, and in that respect, it kind of changed our outlook to a certain degree, but it also at the same time, it changed the public's viewpoint of what Simon Dupree was. And then we started getting bagged into these shitty, excuse my French, working men's clubs to play the hits up in Stockport and you know, God knows where else. Mm-hmm. And that really started to get to me and get to the band because we were getting good musically. But one of the most, believe it or not, important aspects of that period of time was when Red Dwight joined the band.
That's right, yes. We were going to bring that up, obviously, yes.
He was intrinsic in some respects of saying, hey, boy, you're really good. I said, well, thanks, Red, you are too, you know.
Hang on, how did you and Elton John get to meet? I know he wasn't Elton John there, but how did that happen?
Well, a keyboard player at the time, he came down with quite a serious case of glandular fever. We were booked on a tour of the UK, but you know, some parts of Europe. And I think Jerry Braun, who was the manager at the time, had heard from Dick James that this guy, Reg Dwight, was looking for a gig. And he was getting £10 a week from Dick James. And we met Elton, I call him Elton now, Reg. He's obviously a good player. And I said, would you like to come on tour and be the keyboard player for Simon Dupree? He said, yeah, and we can offer him £25 a week. He said, that's 2.5 times what I'm getting. God, I'm going to be rich, you know. Anyway, so he came on tour with us, and he was hilarious. And we're still friends, by the way, after, you know, 40-odd years of, years.
He wrote a song for you, didn't he? He recorded one of his songs?
He wrote several songs, but a couple were recorded. But he was actually the one that said, you know, have you heard of this band called Spirit in America? And you could do some interesting things, et cetera, et cetera. And that's towards the end of the group. And he introduced us to some bands that we hadn't known before. We were still rocking, doing, you know, sort of Otis Redding stuff and this, that, and the other. And this is actually when he met Bernie. He actually wrote a couple of songs and played on several other tracks that we never released. But anyway, he introduces to this band Spirit, who was out of California, mm-hmm. and he said they're doing really interesting things, and they were. And so it kind of like, together with Reg being part of the group and him introducing us to different things, and then we whispered in his ear that we were going to break up the band and we were going to do something completely new, because it was getting, playing these working men's clubs and the people eating scampi and chips in front of us, waiting for the hits, was like, I can't tell you how depressing it was, you know, even though we were getting good money. And I said, we can't do this anymore. So we were lucky in the fact that we were able to have a patron, in fact, with our manager, Jerry Braun, who we told we want to break up the band as something completely new. We don't know where it's going to be and what it's going to do, but we can't do this anymore. And he said, well, I believe in you musicians. And in fact, Reg said, I'd love to, you know, audition to be your keyboard player. You know, we went up to his house in Watford. It was that was the north of London, and with his mom there.
Pinner, isn't it?
Pinner, thank you. Yeah, exactly that. And, you know, he started playing Your Song and Skyline Pigeon. Me and Ray went home on the train and said, he's a great guy, but it's not going to work for us. So he said, you know, Reg, you know, it's not going to work. Thank God for him. Because a year later, he was Elton John he was incredibly famous. And a year later, we were scrapping to get gigs in Portsmouth. So thank God we turned him down.
Derek, I love that story because, you know, what Elton's really famous for is always having his ear to the ground as far as contemporary music is concerned. Even
Absolutely.
Today, I mean, you know, yeah. We had the Anchoress on recently and Elton's a fan of hers. I mean, all the way through his career. And the fact that he helped to turn you guys onto a particular more complex music, which helped you evolve and, you know, he was there then. But I do want to jump back to Kites because I found out something really fun about Kites. I don't know where the guy found this out, but he might enjoy this. But on that song, you can hear a woman's voice speaking, which is, you know, in itself quite a proggy thing anyway, but speaking in Mandarin, you know, small nothings or whatever it is. And I found out she's an actress called Jackie Chan, who was the woman who had an affair with Anthony Armstrong Jones. And she, in The Crown, she's been played by an actor in The Crown, isn't she?
That's deep research, Gary.
Deep research. She was in a West End play called Tea House of the August Moon.
Oh! Which was a film with Marlon Brando and someone, I can't remember else. Anyway.
And the follow-up to that was that she couldn't speak a word of Mandarin or any Chinese, and it was all phonetically put in front of her. But she was found by our manager, who was my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law was a producer on the BBC. So in that respect, we had some good ins there. So God knows, he may have been having some secret affair with her as well. I don't know. I'm not going to say a word. However,
she's still around. Careful.
All right. Well, while we're on that period.
Zip.
The Moles.
Yeah. It's The Moles. That was our, me and Ray and Phil were given time in EMI. And we said, let's download, like, do something which is, you know, crazy. And you know, John, again, our manager said, go ahead, you know, let's try something out. You know, it wasn't the rest of the band. So I think Ray played drums. I played guitar and Ray played bass and Phil and myself sang. And we produced this song called We Are the Moles. And it was released and there was a buzz going on and it started hitting the charts. And people thought, I guess, you know, radio and other people who had heard it thought this is either the Beatles or some other, you know, with this weird band we've heard about, you know, in London called Pink Floyd, whatever, you know, this is great and everything else. And it started getting a big buzz. And then at the time, little did I know that Pink Floyd, in fact, were about to do their 3-hour session. So this is getting a big buzz and it started to make noise. We thought, wow, this is possibly going to be a hit as big as Kites. And Sid Barrett, in an interview in the NME or the Melody Maker, I can't remember which, or both, said, no, this isn't the Beatles or Pink Floyd. It's that bullshit band, Simon Dupree. We saw them, you know. So he basically sort of like ratted us out, you know. So
But that's quite fun, because you know that Gary and I are in a band with Nick Mason. We're about to go on tour playing Sid's music. So
really?
Yeah, we'll be in the States later on this year as well. So we'll
let us know for sure. Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc, and it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers, and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. So the beginning of Gentle Giant, and I mean, what a leap, you know, musically, to go from, you know, the Moles and that psychedelia to, you know, the first Gentle Giant album. Those beginnings and those rehearsals and those recordings, that was such a leap of faith for you to decide to make this kind of music.
Well, yeah, it was. And it was a leap that we had to do. We were getting good. I knew we were, and getting better at our instrumentation. But we were stymied by the fact that, you know, the hits, or the couple of big hits we had, were millstones around our necks. So we couldn't progress any further. So when we asked a manager that we were going to break up, would you be prepared to fund us through a period of 6 to 9 months of finding the right musicians to go into some other sphere of music that we want to do, he said, yeah, I'm prepared to do that, which is unheard of in this day and age.
I just want to get your influences clear in my head, because I'm not sure quite of the timeline, but, you know, when I listen to what you're doing, you can hear King Crimson, obviously, is a comparable band, Soft Machine, bands from the Canterbury scene, you know, whether it's Camel or whatever. That's the world you're living in. What, were you hearing any of that?
No. No, because we're at this, all at the same time. It was if you squash all that period of things, all these bands, into a period of a year, all these guys, I mean, Crimson were called League of Gentlemen, and they lived quite close to us in Bournemouth. All these bands were evolving into something new. Yes, I mean, that was Keith West Tomorrow. You know, that was Steve Howe. Zeppelin was what was it, Band of Joy, you know, et cetera. We were all evolving from these R&B bands that were listening to American music to something new. But we were cocooned in Portsmouth. We weren't part of the establishment in London. So we were kind of like almost hermits in our world. Our influences were more jazz-like, if you like. Frank Zappa was a huge influence. The band that Elton suggested, The Spirit, which is not four bars and three chords and a vocal and a pre-chorus, et cetera, et cetera.
But also what turned me on as a kid, because I was really excited by the whole folk revival thing that was happening and, you know, with bands, Pentagon, whatever, that it was, no.
A Pentangle, yeah.
Pentangle.
Jethro Tull.
Jethro Tull. And well, I felt that, you know, you using folk music.
Yeah.
And madrigals.
Yeah.
And something that was about a nostalgia for a particular time that was, you know, more childlike, if you like. That was all in there as well.
Well, there's also losing the reliance on Americana.
That's correct. Yeah. Isn't it? That's yeah. And actually, the person who is probably most responsible, if you like, for that is Kerry. Because, again, Kerry Minear, he was born in the West Country and went to, you know, Royal Academy of Music. And, you know, his faith is Christian and his church music is very sort of apparent in some of the songs we've recorded. The various kind of chord sequences, sometimes you'll hear kind of church-like and folk-like stuff. But he was, again, an incredible musician. He is.
Was that him and Tony Banks? Tony Banks is the only person you could see as comparable.
Yeah,
to Tony's, that.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
So he was an amazing find as the first musician that we said, come on board and join the band. And luckily he had no gigs to go to. He was penniless, coming out of in a band out of Germany. And he came down to Portsmouth from London. And he brought some songs. And anyway, so we had to carry. And then we were looking for a guitarist. Again, we didn't know what we were looking for, but someone who could complement the three brothers in our adventure into God knows where. Honestly, we didn't quite know where it was, but we all had different influences. And that we put an ad, and there was about 50 to 60 guitarists that came down to where we were, and in London too.
What did your ad say? No breadheads or time wasters.
No, I think because we were quasi promised a record deal. I mean, that was part of the equation, because luckily then we were band with a record deal seeking a great. I wish I could find it. It'd be great.
Derek, you did the first album at Trident, the famous Trident down in Soho, which is where actually I recorded. Spandau Ballet recorded their first single,
oh, really?
At Trident. Yeah, to cut a long story short. But T-Rex had recorded their, Tyrannosaurus Rex at the time, and obviously Bowie later. And it was all through Tony Visconti. Tony Visconti was your producer.
Oh, yeah.
What a choice that was, because he was coming out of that whole folk world of Tyrannosaurus Rex, wasn't he? This new folk world.
Yeah, well, Tony was very, very, he was fantastic, and he still is. But he was a fantastic mentor for the band to teach us, if you like, how to record an album in the studio. Until then, we just done singles. On the first album, you know, you probably know in those days there were certain, you couldn't block out a week at Dryden, because next door was Queen, you know, there was Roy Baker, and then you got Mark Bowen waiting outside for his session, and you got, you know, Bowie parking his car waiting for his session. It was amazing, actually. Yeah, we were lucky that Tony was there, and he's also a great musician. You know, Tony, I mean, he was the one that actually sort of put together the recorder quartet in the first album. And we befriended him. And in fact, coming from Portsmouth to stay in London for a few days when we were doing our first album, he let us crash on his floor at Putney. We didn't have money for a hotel. Are you kidding? So he was going out at the time with Mary Hopkins. So she was in her bedroom, and I was sleeping on the floor in the bedroom, you know. So, but Tony was great. I mean, he was incredibly... You know, he's a mentor and gave us a lot of help and teaching the band to be a recording band. You know, at the same time, we'd, you know, come back after we'd finished our session, and he'd be recording, you know, Mark Bowen. And we see Mark in the studio. To us, it was hilarious because he loved all these bands, you know, and Mark was literally rolling on the floor with his guitar. And we, you know, being the cynical people we are, we'd be cracking up and saying, this guy's a loony. You know, this is a... But it turned out great. And then you mentioned George Underwood with a cover.
Yeah.
I guess you know the story there with George and Tony.
Tell it, please.
Tony suggested that, you know, again, he was very involved, actually, in the first record. In fact, it was his little story, which is in the inside sleeve of the album, This is Tony Visconti.
I want to stop you there because I did write that quote down. Tony wrote on the front of the cover, it says, to expand the frontiers of contemporary popular music at the risk of becoming unpopular.
That was the second album.
That was the second, yeah.
That was my brother.
Oh, it was the second album. Yeah. Okay.
That was my brother being, how can I put this? A little pompous.
Bold.
And
bold. It's a bold statement.
Bold and not quite what we exactly wanted to say in those words, but...
Let's get back to your George Underwood story.
Yeah.
So Tony said, I got a couple of really good artists that can give it a shot. David, his best friend, is a guy called George Underwood. And, David Bowie was... We saw him. He was there in the studio with his... with the guys from Hull, coming up to play with him. I mean, it was great, actually. I can't tell you what a fun time that was. Everyone was there together, But anyway, George was Bowie's best friend for years until he died, actually. He said, I want you to meet George. He's great. And I said, okay, George, why don't you put a picture of Gentle Giant together? And George came back like a week later in a session and presented us with what you see as Gentle Giant. And we thought, wow, okay, thanks, Tony. This will work. And that was Gentle Giant.
I just want to fill some of the listeners in, is that George Underwood was the guy that punched David Bowie in the face over a row with a girlfriend at school. And that's what damaged David's eye and why he's always had that funny eye. That's George who did that. I know George, and I told him you were coming on the show.
Please give him my
And he
love.
Said... Yeah. He said the same to you. He said, pass on my love, please. I said, where is that? I asked him where that artwork was, the original Gentle Giant cover of the face. He said he still has it at home.
Well, I want it. I'll pay for it.
In America, it was the first and second albums, or it was two albums, or wasn't it? Well, there was some confusion.
No, it was the third album, actually.
I'm sacking my researcher.
His researcher's me.
Well, there's a lot of more research to be done. Now, the first two albums were kind of like, they leaked out. They weren't released, essentially. And when Three Friends was released, they put the Giant's face on Columbia, put the Giant's face on Three Friends. Right. And that was the first real release we had in North America. It became an emblem of the band, and it became the sort of, it was our trademark and our stamp and our, I hate to use the word
logo.
And that was George. And I can't thank him enough for coming up with a crazy, weird, bald guy.
No, but it's not. But it makes you friendly and approachable, which, seeing as some of your music was quite challenging, that's quite a nice thing to welcome people in.
I remember seeing it in the stores when I was a kid, in the shops, and being really attracted to that cover. But I do want to sort of mention Octopus, the album Octopus, which came, in 1972, which... I think is your greatest piece of work as a band. I mean, it's the album I always go back to when I'm scanning your music. And it was with a new drummer. I mean, John Weathers, what a drummer.
Absolutely.
Really added to the sound. I mean, but that opening track, The Advent of Panurge, what a song. And it got remixed by Stephen Wilson recently.
Yeah.
I mean, you were peaking then, weren't you, really? That was hitting your stride.
Yeah, I think we were. I mean, I think we... if you're a musician, it's kind of like if you're in a real band for a long period of time, you start off kind of like at birth and you become an adolescent and then you become, a young adult and then you become mature and you start knowing who you really are. So at that point with the six piece with my brother Phil, that was the last album he was on, we started to know who Gentle Giant was. And the music that we were made is what we were. And I think that also having Martin Rushen as the engineer was also key as well. Because Martin, it was an incredible asset to the band too.
And Martin obviously went on to do, produce
The Human League.
And Altered Images.
And The Stranglers, I believe. No?
Of course,
So it was a peak there where we were starting to really get into our stride. And at the same time, we'd done a lot of touring, mostly as guests, but we've started to become headliners at some point in certain parts of the world. I mean, certainly Europe. In Italy, we became very big, and Germany, and some parts of North America. Jethro Tull were very accommodating to the band. I mean, they loved us, they were incredibly generous in that we did three big tours with them in North America and Europe. We remain friends to the day, you know, Ian and myself and Martin and all those guys. So, you know, I think it's a really good album. I think you're right. It's one of my favorites too. But after that, my brother Phil started feeling the effects of, number one, having a family at home. He was the only one married with kids. And it was very tough for him to leave them for months at a time. And in those days, we were touring the States for 3 or 4 months back to back.
And contact was different, wasn't it? It was expensive phone calls and, you know,
There's no cells or texts or anything like that. And to tell you the truth, I mean, the gig money was going on the phone calls. I mean, you know, and we said, Phil, enough of this shit.
Were you angry with your brother for leaving?
To a certain degree, yeah. To a certain extent, there was...
Did that take long to heal?
Yeah. Actually, after the last American tour, which is the Octopus tour, he flew back to the UK from North America a couple of times to be with his family, which cost the band a substantial amount of money, to tell you the truth. You know, because we had like 3 days off. You know, we're not talking about us, you know, at that point getting, you know, $100,000 a gig. We're talking about, you know, enough to put bread on the table. And then we went to Italy. He kept saying, look, this is tough behind, you know, I got to go back. I'm not sure if I get this and the other. We had another manager at that time. And ultimately, the decision was brought to a head. And Pat Meehan, who was the manager at that time from Worldwide Artists, said, Phil, are you in the band or are you out of the band? And he sat there and said, I'm out of the band. And literally within half an hour, he was packing his bags and leaving Milan to go home. And that was it. And it kind of left us high and dry in Italy. And we finished our Italian tour as a five piece. And it was.
Well, because you're all multi-instrumentalists, yeah. So I'm wondering how if you've managed to fill the
bits. Yeah, we had to literally have a couple of days off to learn the parts that he had done and all the other various, to juggle around. But it was very traumatic, especially for me and Ray, as siblings. But honestly, it was the best thing for Phil, ultimately, when you reflect back on it, because he had a family and he probably would have broken up with his family. And, you know, but at that time, it was all about the band. And suddenly it wasn't. On a personal level, you know, he's our brother. You know, and honestly, sibling rivalry in a band, as you probably know, can be quite good and creative sometimes. But three brothers is a whole different thing. And Phil was 10 years older than I am. And I was kind of the quasi-leader, but Phil wanted to be there too. And there was a lot of this going on. And my poor brother Ray was a peacemaker. And the rest of the band used to cower in the corner saying, oh, no, let them stop arguing, for Christ's sake. So, yeah, there was a period of time after he quit, left, was kicked out, whatever it was, that we didn't speak, none of us, because we were left high and dry. And we were left high and dry. Without any kind of like safety net, if you like. However, it made the band much more streamlined. And John's addition in Octopus, of course, was absolutely incredible. I mean, he's a drummer, bar none. I mean, an incredible drummer, rock drummer. And I think that it forced us into a direction which was much more focused. And as a five-piece, I think we really came into our own in a different fashion than Octopus.
Yeah, there's some live video footage out there of you, I think, in about 1976, where you're all wearing white. I think you've got a white boiler suit on.
Yeah, well forget that one, man.
A la Townsend.
Oh, my God, though. But what I love about it, Guy, is that their chops are so incredible.
Oh, no, they're amazing. There's quite a lot of live stuff. There was a BBC thing you did, which is fantastic as a concert.
But they're all having such 76. Joy doing it. And there's a sense of humour in what they're doing as well.
That's something that, I guess, was very important to us. Yeah, we were damn good musicians, but we didn't take ourselves seriously. We took our music seriously, but we liked to enjoy it, and we wanted to show the audience that we enjoyed it, and we wanted to see smiles on people's faces.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted to surprise and shock them, and we weren't like looking down at our instruments and pretending we were Segovia or you know, God knows, you know, we want to entertain. We wanted to smile. We were smiling because we enjoyed it.
But do you think that's a dimension that kind of really came over in your music live that maybe
I think
didn't that, happen on record? Yeah,
yeah, I think you're people correct. Yeah. That was a very important factor. Yeah.
Derek, is it fair to say that by the end of the 80s, with albums like Giant for a Day and Civilian, you'd sort of lost your way musically a little bit, as you'd left those roots behind, and there was a sort of a striving to become a sort of contemporary rock group?
Well, Missing Piece was the start of that. And, you know, look, at that time...
With your punk attempt.
Let's forget that one. I mean, I rarely regret anything I've done in my life. I mean, I don't, actually. But that punk attempt, I wish that it wasn't there.
I think it's great. I think it's good fun, actually.
Well, I'm glad you do. Whenever I put on any kind of recorded piece of music, I try and skip over that one. Anyway, nevertheless, there were bands who were on the level that we were. I mean, we were playing to pretty big places. Even though we were, you know, cast as a cult band, we were certainly playing like 20,000 seaters in Italy and Germany and Quebec and Montreal and LA, et cetera, et cetera. But the bands who were bagged alongside us in whatever is called progressive, like Yes and Crimson, you know, ELP and Genesis, of course, saw what was coming and said, okay, we better have a pop song that, you know, kind of transcends who we were and gets a new audience, which is on their way to being relevant. Well, you know, I guess we thought in our own naive way that we could do the same thing. Well, of course, one thing that Gentle Giant can never do, unfortunately, in retrospect, was write a really good pop song. You know, we were good at, you know, putting sort of quirky 7-8-5-4 stuff together and confusing the public, but to put a, you know, a three chord or a five chord chorus and B section was difficult for us, or it wasn't difficult, but what we didn't do the same thing that Yes and Genesis were able to do. So yeah, I guess we did try to sort of make ourselves more commercial. But in some respects, again, if you continue to do the same kind of thing every day, every year, that's timing in effect as well. You know, so yeah. And again, the fans, if you like, may want you to, but you know, we didn't want to. So giving something a shot, there's nothing wrong in it, even if it's a failure or a success.
Because it's funny, because on Civilian, sorry to interrupt.
No, go
really
on.
Sorry, yeah. Terrible habit. On Civilian, for some reason, I've got down in my notes, what I was hearing was like 10cc.
10cc is one of my favourite groups.
Art rock.
10cc were great. I mean, I'm unbelievable group. They're great writers and great singers. For me, Civilian's one of my favourite albums, believe it or not. I mean, you know, it's
right.
Because I think we had Jeff Emmerich. It was the only album we did in America. The interesting thing about Jeff Emmerich was that Jeff Emmerich was the very first engineer on the very first single that Simon Dupree ever did in Abbey Road.
Wow.
All right. Because he was a Beatles engineer, wasn't he?
Yeah. And, you know, he was running the four track.
Because George Martin was involved back then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. In Abbey Road, yeah. Yeah, so he was the engineer in the very first single, and he was the engineer on the very last album. So it's kind of a bookend to have Jeff. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago, which is terrible. But anyway, I think Civilian is a different album to Octopus. It's a different album to Freehand. You know, it doesn't have a lot of different time signatures, but I think there's a lot of great dynamics in it. In fact, we're actually in the process of releasing it again. Not again, because it was hardly even released, actually, when it came out first. But now there's a lot of interest in it from, you know, the fans that poo-pooed it back in the day and now think, oh, it's pretty damn great, actually. So in May, we're putting it out remastered with an extra track, which was never put on it.
Forgive me, Derek, then, for saying that you'd lost your way. I think what I was implying was that, you know, it was your last album and you decided to leave the music business. But, well, decided to leave the music business as a musician.
Before going to that, just one last point, because I want to say, because I do think you're doing yourself a bit of an injustice earlier, Derek, because I think Civilian shows that you were capable of a certain pop sound.
I think so too, actually.
I would say.
No, I think you're right. And in fact, but unfortunately, due to really bizarre circumstances, which I won't get into, it wasn't given the real shot that it deserved. Again, maybe that was the point that it was time to, you know, close that door and open another one for all of us. There's a certain chapter, and if you don't close that chapter, you continue and you can start to become a parody of who you were. And that's something I never, ever wanted to be. And I don't think any of us wanted to be.
So tell us about you becoming an A&R man. This was in the States, right?
Yeah. I was living in America. My wife's American. And I was living in California at the time. We broke up. I mean, we were supposed to do a European tour after this last American tour. And we said, no, we're done. Here I was living in L.A., which I hated, to be honest with you. And knowing a few people around, they said, would you like to produce a couple of bands that were around? I wasn't sure. Honestly, I wasn't even sure what I wanted to do. And then kind of a year of like sitting, twiddling my thumbs and going to see bands and hanging out, I got a call from a friend who had worked at Chrysalis Records, who we were signed to, in New York, to a guy called Dan Young. He said, hey, you know, what are you up to? He said, not much. He said, well, have you ever thought about joining the dark side, being Darth Vader? You know, I said, are you kidding me? I'm at PolyGram, which is, at that point, there was a company called Siemens and Philips. They're companies together. They call this company PolyGram. And we're looking for a couple of people to be in the department called the rock department. You know, I could use a job because my savings were kind of like dwindling down to, you know, me shaking a cup outside of the Hollywood Bowl, you know. I'd be interested in talking. So I flew to New York and I met this gentleman, Jerry Jaffe, who is the head of the rock department at PolyGram. And he knew in a kind of bizarre way that the two people that were very important in promoting rock music in this new form of AOR, a guy called Lee Abrams and a guy called Jeff Pollock, they were chief consultants in consulting radio stations, which have become very, very narrow in their playlists. But they were both big, big fans of Gentle Giant. And he figured if I get this guy B, I could get to them and get bands like The Jam, all the other stuff that he liked on the radio, Rory Gallagher, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, the bottom line is I got the job. And in 82, I was living in New York as, well, initially it was a promotion slash artist development, trying to get, as I said, The Jam on radio.
Can we bring John Bon Jovi into the picture now?
Yeah.
My first go-round in A&R, believe it or not, was Uriah Heep when I was doing promotion. Jerry Brom was our mentor back in the day. He was trying to shop Uriah Heep's, the hell's the album? Abominog?
Abominog, yeah.
Anyway, he couldn't get a deal. And I said, I heard a couple of songs and I said, I think this could work. Anyway, I got the people at the company to sign them. They resurged it with a hit. And I said, but now, you know, I think I have a clue about this. Anyway, I got my way into being the director of A&R. And within the first couple of weeks, you know, there was a song I'd heard on the radio that I kept putting on. There was a song called Runaway. And I kept hearing it. And I thought, what the hell is this? At the same time, a lawyer from Philadelphia came up and said, have you heard this song called Runaway? It's by a kid called John Bon Jovi. I said, funny, yeah, I've heard it. And it's damn good. What is this? Anyway, he said, he's putting a band together. Would you like to, you know, hear him and see him? I said, sure. Anyway, so he gave me four songs, a four-song demo. And so I got to meet John.
Because he was working at Power Station, wasn't he, John? He told us, because he's been on the show as well. We've had him on.
It was Cousin's Studio.
Yeah, second cousin. Yeah,
his cousin's studio, yeah. Tony.
Anyway, yeah, so he was working at the Power Station, kind of. You know, Runaway was done by session musicians. But he was putting his band together. And he said, would you like to come see the band in a couple of gigs? And you know, I went to see them at a couple of, I can't remember what show it was, at a showcase. And Richie had just joined. And they put on a couple of shows. And they were good. You know, they were really good, actually. But, you know, John, he wasn't sure whether he wanted to be Rex Smith or David Lee Roth, because he was shaking his ass in a blue and purple leather pants. So literally, I you know, took him aside, you know, and said, John, you guys are really good. I'm going to introduce you to the rest of the label. They did a showcase for the rest of the company, if you like, or the rock department. And to tell you the truth, it wasn't a very good one. But I believed in John, because John was a person I sat down with. And I don't think I've ever sat down with someone so driven to be, even at that stage in his career, a teenager, you know, who'd written a couple of decent songs. He said, I'm going to be as big as Elvis. I promise you. And that's what he said to me. And I, come on. Right. And he wasn't kidding. You look in someone's eyes and when they say that, you want to see the wink. But no. So his mom and his dad were basically looking after him. So his mom said, John, I mean, I'd like to meet this guy, Derek. And so I went down in Sayreville, New Jersey with John, you know, and I was really interested in signing him, even though some of the guys didn't like them. Carol Bon Jovi said, please take care of John if you do. So we signed Bon Jovi.
And this is New Jersey Italians. Hey, take care of John.
Yeah. I want to skip to the meat and potatoes, really, because you nurtured John through two albums that weren't that, you know, huge as Bon Jovi. But then you did something extraordinary and you put John in a room with Desmond Childs.
Correct. So
who's one of the top songwriters, right?
Well, at that point, he was getting there.
Yeah, getting there.
Yeah, I was introduced to by Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons to Desmond because I was working with Kiss as well. And they wrote a couple of Lick It Up, for instance. And I was working that. I said, who's this Child guy on your record? And he said, well, there's a band called Desmond Child and Rouge. He's a great songwriter. And I said, wow, okay. Can you introduce me? So Gene introduced it to Desmond because John was, I have to say, open to co-writing. He was that determined. And I said, boy, do I mention someone? He said, yeah, I'd love to meet someone who's a really, really good writer. So I said to John, there's a guy called Desmond Child who wrote a couple of Kiss songs. Why don't you guys get together? So they got together and they started writing Slippery When Wet. And at that same time, I'd heard, you know, Bruce Fairburn and Bob Rock's productions of Loverboy and a couple of other Canadian rock bands. And they were superb. They were great productions. And I got hold of Bruce and Bob, and I said, I've got this band who were coming up. They're doing really well. I got Doc McGee involved, and he got them on the road, and they learned their chops by going out there with, you know, Van Halen, Scorpions, God knows what else. Anyway, they said, okay, we'll produce it. And so they went up to Vancouver with Desmond and Bob and Bruce, and Slippery When Wet was produced.
Living on a Prayer is one of the biggest hits of all time.
Yeah.
Because of you, Derek.
Derek, I've got to say, do you not think there's a certain irony in the fact that you had this musical career, right, with a very bold statement of what you were going to do? And you did, I would say that Gentle Giant probably at the time did commercially as well as they could have been expected to do. Like you said, you ended up doing really big gigs and everything like that. But then after that, it turns out that the one thing you really know how to do is spot a hit.
Well, yes, I did. I learned. It's not such a hit. Now, I learned how to see
an artist, I guess.
An artist, yeah. Who didn't just like, want to be on the charts or want to be famous, but who wanted to, who had it in their DNA that if they stepped on stage, what was their purpose? And John's purpose, you know, was to be as big as ever, to be as big as Elvis. That's what he said.
In his own words, I've seen a million faces and I've rocked them all.
Yeah, exactly that.
Derek, I just want to tell the listeners who else you sort of helped along and brought into the world. I mean, Cinderella, obviously this whole hair metal thing that started in the 80s, you know, really came out of those kind of bands, Kingdom Come and Slipknot and Pantera. I mean, metal seemed to be your thing, but the other huge hit that you helped bring the world was Nickelback. And, you know, I've forgotten the name of the track now, but it was one of the biggest songs of all time.
How you remind me.
Thank you. To finish off, we want to hear about this one.
Well, Nickelback's another interesting little sidebar because they had recorded the first album, not Sunny Side Up, the one before, themselves. They were a Vancouver band. And I'd heard this song, Leader of Men. I was running Roadrunner Records at the time. I was president of Roadrunner. And my A&R guy called Steve Berman had a bunch of tapes. I said, "Give me, you know, what are you listening to?" He says, "This, I've got this, I've got this, and I've got this." He gave me this tape of a band called Nickelback. And I heard it. I said, "Who's this?" He said, "Some band out of Vancouver." And I kept putting this track, Leader of Men, on because one thing I know about myself is if I hear a track and I want to hear it again, and it sticks in your head, you say, "Why do you want to hear it again?" Because it was such an unusual arrangement because it wasn't a verse chorus, you know, verse chorus, B section, you know, solo. It was four sections of the same thing, but so well put together. Songwriting wise, I said, "Who's Nickelback?" Anyway, the bottom line is I went up to see these guys and I said, "So what's the story with your album?" He said, "Well, we can't get a deal." He said, "We've done this album on our own. We can't even get a Canadian deal." Anyway, the bottom line is I did the very cheap deal for the album. Leader of Men came out, and it really was a precursor to the next album. And when I heard the demo for How You Remind Me, I knew they had hit the jackpot. And that was, again, one of the biggest tracks of all time in the like early, I can't remember, the 2000s. This has got the same kind of attention for being a hit that, I guess, Living on a Prayer, it's got a double chorus.
In rock history, they have a funny sort of place, don't they? And it's very similar to the story of Grand Funk Railroad back in the early 70s, who sold out masses of arenas and were huge and yet were hated by the press. And Nickelback live in that sort of strange world, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It's elitism, which is based on bullshit. You know, they're corporate, they play simple music. But you know what? That music, I mean, Chad is a damn good songwriter. Let me tell you that. And yeah. You know, he writes great songs. Unfortunately, he opens his mouth a little too much in the wrong way. You know, and I've had that with other bands that have a self-destruct elements to them as well. But nevertheless, you know, yeah, they became the emblem of corporate rock, which is kind of silly and elitist and nonsense because, you know what, look at what's happening with the corporate hip-hop world, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's a whole different animal. But, yeah, they became this kind of joke, if you like. The joke is on Nickelback. But you know what? They can take their joke and spend their joke money in the bank. But yeah. The bottom line is I had the same feeling about How You Remind Me as I did when I heard Bad Name and Living on a Prayer. I just knew they had their songs.
Derek, thank you.
Yeah, it's been really and long. We've had a very, very, that's brilliant. Fantastically engaging. Fantastically engaging. It's great.
A massive career you've had, Derek. Yeah. And, you know, we spoke about you in the intro. What you've given the music world is quite an extraordinary and diverse set of records.
What should I be sorry about?
No, you shouldn't be.
I suppose that what's wonderful is that there is very much a resurgence of interest in all your stuff, and I think that's great and it's well deserved.
Can we get Gentle Giant back on stage?
Well, in wheelchairs and crutches, yeah.
Come on.
No.
I mean, is it? There's none of that's possible.
No, I know. Again, it's the same thing as every chapter has a close, every chapter has an ending, and that was part of a chapter. That was the end of the chapter. Let's move on to another chapter. I never want to be a parody of myself, and I don't think any of us, certainly my brothers, and we'd never want that either.
Brilliant.
Thank you to your son, Noah, for helping us get you on, because we've been trying to get you on for a while, and it's been total pleasure having you.
And me too. And it's a pleasure speaking to you guys as well.
We're at the Beacon Theatre in September or October, and if you're around, we'd love you.
It's just down the street from me here.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that Paul Stanley, who we had on the show from Kiss,
he mentioned you as well. You're everywhere. You're the Kevin Bacon of rock and roll. Ah, really
6 degrees. You weren't in the 6 degrees. You weren't in the 3 degrees, were you? All right, Derek. All the best.
Yeah, you too, man. Thanks
Thank you,
much.
Sir.
Cheers, Derek. All the very best.
Thank you very much.
That was great.
Wow, that was a long one, but it was, you know, he's got so much stuff.
You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American lives. And, well, he's not American, because that's a hell of a second act.
That's a beautiful quote, that guy. I like that. You worked on that one, did you?
I have my moments of inspiration, Gary.
Do you know, just if people are going to go and who haven't heard Gentle Giant and going to listen to some of the tracks which we mentioned earlier, but there's one track I do want to point you to, which is on the Octopus album. It's called Think of Me with Kindness. I sent it to you the other day, Guy, when I'm saying
yes, you did. Yeah, it's amazing.
Beautiful. And it's really.
But he doesn't sing
it. He doesn't sing it. It's Kerry Mannier and it's his song, but it's unbelievably gorgeous. Oh, well, we better wrap up.
We better get out of here. So it's good night from me.
It's good night from the Octopus.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.